Now, the killing of George Floyd and the video of his last minutes sparked a huge wave of protests around the country and around the world. Those protests still continue in many American communities. But what does it take for a protest movement to translate into real changes in policies and in culture at large? David S. Meyer is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine, where he studies social movements, political sociology, and public policy. You can follow his blog at politicsoutdoors.com. David, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you, Rob.
What was it about this moment that led to this really seemingly spontaneous wave of protests in the Midwest, around the country, and then around the world?
I think there were a lot of things that came together in an unexpected way. One thing was the graphic and very, very disturbing video of George Floyd's throat being crushed. And it came right after the story of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky and right after Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. So I think that people were tuned into it in a way they wouldn't have been otherwise. And remember, it came in the middle of this pandemic when people have been at home watching more TV, watching more videos than ever before. So the message transmitted more quickly, and people were ready to get out and do something. And then we have to remember the organizing on Black Lives Matter that had been going on since 2013, since Trayvon Martin, which had been promoting criticism of racialized police violence with lots and lots of cases in between then and now. So I think there was a lot of loading up of capacity that was ready to take off when the right spark hit.
Right. I use the phrase out of nowhere, but as you've written and as you just said, this wasn't out of nowhere. This built on years of Black Lives Matter protests and a longer, historical civil rights movement here in the United States. Can you talk a little bit about how precursors like early Black Lives Matter protests can lead to something bigger down the road?
Well, what happened is that the Black Lives Matter was a hashtag that was started by three women activists that was in response to the killing of Trayvon Martin by an independent security guy, not a police officer, so a wannabe police officer. And it spread a message about violence against black people, sometimes police violence. And that message was picked up in all kinds of surprising ways. I mean, it doesn't take much to think back and remember LeBron James and Dwayne Wade wearing hoodies with the rest of the Miami Heat, the team they were both then on, to draw attention to Trayvon Martin's killings. And then later, when Eric Garner was strangled on video by a police officer in Staten Island, you also saw the I Can't Breathe shirts that basketball players were wearing. And it went across social media, got a lot of attention, not a lot of policy response right away, but it brought attention to the issue. And that was important in setting up circumstances which activists today could take advantage of. There's another piece of it that I think is important, which is that there was an unprecedented resistance to Donald Trump as president, which started before he became president, and certainly took off with the Women's March and then the March of the Week every week afterwards in Washington, and then organizing in congressional districts through Indivisible and other groups. So there are a lot of people who didn't necessarily come to protest with a particular concern about racialized police violence, but were already polarized and ready to take action against the current administration. I think it made it possible for the Black Lives Matter activists to build a broader coalition than they had been able to build in the past.
A challenge for any protest movement is, what message are you sending? What do you have a cohesive message, specific policy guidelines? And that's hard with decentralized protests where people are showing up maybe with different agendas, different ideas, big goals, small goals. Does that get in the way for this or any other movement of making change?
Well, that's always the way it happens. I mean, when we look back in history, we tend to smooth out the rough spots in protest movements. But protest, particularly big events, always are broad coalitions with people who have different priorities in terms of what issue are they working on. Are they working on racial justice? Are they working on economics? Are they working on the environment? big demonstrations of today, all those things are together. And how far are they, do they want to go? And again, there's always a broad spectrum. When we look back, we take a look back at 1963 and we take a line out of Martin Luther King's speech and say, oh, he was just against bigotry. Well, that was a march for a guaranteed jobs for everyone also, which we can forget if we're not paying attention. So what happens always is that opponents will pick on what they think are the most divisive claims that somebody at a demonstration has, and you're never going to get all the things you ask for. But the synergy of lots of different claims, different people, different goals, creates a pressure for government to do something. And when we look back, we might think that that's all the protest movement wanted. It almost never is.
We're talking to David Meyer, sociologist and expert on social movements and protest at the University of California, Irvine, looking at the current protests against police brutality and racial injustice, how they compare to movements of the past. I want to give a listen to a Wisconsin politician, Wisconsin State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a Republican, speaking in Madison. This is this week, the morning after a protest that ultimately included the toppling of two statues in Madison on the Capitol Square and an attack on Democratic State Senator Tim Carpenter. Here's a listen.
We know that in the United States and Wisconsin and every community around our state, peaceful protest is one of the ways that change occurs. But violent protest, where a mob forms and government refuses to act, is the exact opposite of how change will occur. For those people who decided that the way to express themselves was through criminal acts and things that the entire state of Wisconsin now looks at our capital city in shock and awe, that is something that should never be tolerated. It should have never gotten to this point.
So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss there. And again, this is a common theme in protests and protest movements when violence of some sort breaks out. Can you talk about that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, when Robin Voss is giving advice to protesters for social justice, you can't assume that he's really looking out for your best interests. When people said, oh, I respect Colin Kaepernick's right to protest, just not about the flag, not where anybody can see it. Those people are not trying to help Colin Kaepernick be effective. Robin Voss is not looking out for your interests. And there's something disingenuous about it. They haul out a picture of Martin Luther King and they say, oh, Martin Luther King was peaceful. Well, Martin Luther King was crazy, unpopular, and under surveillance for the last 10 years of his life. So it's a constructed recollection that's really false, and it's used to discredit what people are after now. One. Two, any big movement draws up lots of people in its wake and cannot control all the people who come into a large demonstration. Demonstrations don't have bouncers like bars where they can say, oh, you have to leave. And it is very much the work of opponents to try to discredit an entire movement based on some element that they find offensive. So that's worth thinking about. And this is not new. What were the statues that people were going after?
It was of Hans Hegg, a Wisconsin Union commander, and the Forward statue, kind of a woman representing the spirit of Wisconsin. We don't have, you know, Confederate general statues on the Capitol Square.
I don't see any immediate problem with those statues, and I think there is probably unbridled and undisciplined enthusiasm by some people who were there. I don't know all the stories of those people, but if you don't have a reasonable process for reconsidering the statues that somebody thought were a good idea at some time, then you're going to get citizen movements to try to make their own decisions about it.
We're talking to sociologist and political science professor David Meyer about the politics of protest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. what to you makes an effective protest? Have you demonstrated in the current round of protests or protests against COVID-19 related restrictions? Or do you have a protest history going back maybe as far as the 60s or further? Tell us your story, what you think works, what doesn't, what a protester, what a demonstration can do to win your agreement on an issue or what it can do to turn you away. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about the effectiveness of protests with Professor David Meyer from the University of California, Irvine. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you participated in protests this year or in the past? What was your experience like? Why did you do it? Do you feel like it led to the changes you were hoping for as you watch protests on the news, on TV, wherever? What do you think of what's going on now? Do you worry when violence breaks out or looting? Does that tar the image of the protesters in your mind? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. David, something we've talked about in the past is social media and how that has changed, or maybe in some cases not so much changed, protests. So what do you make of the current state of social media when it comes to protest?
Well, it's amazing that some people have found creative new ways to protest under the restrictions of COVID. I was really moved by the TikTok K-pop teen Trump ticket troll, which I mean, that's a name I just made up. I don't know if it's really what they called it, where the where young people across the United States signed up for the Trump rally and then didn't show up. And it was, you're thinking about these kids, 16, 17, 18, who have been cheated by COVID out of some of the delights of senior year of high school, and they're communicating with each other about Trump and trying to find some way to do something. And it was mostly under the radar of people like me. If we're not on TikTok, if we're not on Instagram, they have ways of getting their own message across and their own media across. So that's something that's exciting. But there's also a nasty underside to it because we don't all operate with the same facts. So social movement becomes a belief system where you can get information that confirms your pre-existing ideas about what's dangerous, about whether masks are dangerous or not dangerous, in which there's no gatekeeper and no necessary expertise, but you get confirmation of the belief you're starting with. So in Wisconsin, I believe you've seen Black Lives Matter protests after George Floyd, and you've seen the Open Up protests too. And I don't think those people are talking to each other or reading the same media.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Joe on the line in Onalaska. Joe, hi. Joe, are you there?
No, this is Steve from Sun Prairie.
Oh, Steve, yeah, let's go with you. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, one of the things that really bothers me is there's a walkaway campaign that's been out there for a few years, and I'm one of them. I was a Democrat, and I left the party. And part of the reason why I left is the hate, the absolutely hate that's ginned up by that party. I know you're gassing and turning into Trump, but it's the Democratic Party. For the guest to make a comment that Robin Voss doesn't have your best interest at mind, I agree a lot with Robin Voss, so therefore he's saying I don't have people's best interest in mind, and that's just hateful. Two good people can disagree on a political solution. Doesn't make one evil and the other one good. That stuff's got to stop.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Do you think, David, that we end up in terms of good and evil?
It's a very, very polarized time. And social movements enhance the polarization, and the Trump administration has also enhanced the polarization. And it means that people take sides, and they often neglect inconsistencies on their own side, and they often overstate the evils of their opponents. But I haven't seen anything that makes me reconsider what I said about Robin Voss.
Thanks for calling in, Steve. We'll go to Joe for real now in Onalaska. Joe, hi.
Hi, thanks for doing this. It's interesting. I think the premise of the question was what makes an effective protest. I'm a former local government official, and I think there's a lot of noise, and I'm not poo-pooing the effectiveness of a nationwide protest, particularly this one. However, I think most of what is capable of being accomplished happens at the local level, and sometimes it's actually a hell of a lot easier if you get aggressively political at the local level because it requires less. I got elected, I think, one time with only about 90 votes to a county position. Even though I knocked on every door in the district, it's just there isn't a lot of turnout. And if you show up, I can count on one hand the number of times people wrote me and called me about an issue. And I think, you know, many of these issues actually are local, and it really saddened me with those statues being torn down in the Capitol, because, you know, I support the goals, I think, generally speaking, of the people who are protesting to affect positive change with regard to law enforcement and Black Lives Matter and all that. However, these statues that were down at the Capitol stand for, you know, women's right to vote, and the Colonel Haig, you know, was somebody who was killed fighting against the Confederacy.
Joe, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a ton of time left. You gave us a lot to work with there. I want to key in on his first point there, David, about getting involved in local politics. I've seen anecdotally this time some people who have been involved in protests then saying, hey, I'm going to run for, you know, a state assembly seat or maybe local government. But as I seem to recall, the Tea Party, it brought some new people in to run for office who might not have run before. Do we often see that, protests leading to local political involvement?
Absolutely. I think Joe is right on target that like hard work at the local level, it's easier to accomplish your policy goals. And the stuff about police policy, a lot of it is done locally. So the idea of getting involved locally matters a lot. The national protests sometimes buoy up people and encourage them to run for office. So you mentioned the Tea Party, where people who came from a protest movement, some of them ran for office and some of them won. I was going through in 2017, I think it was, the Virginia House of Delegates, and I found five successful candidates just from their websites who said the reason they were running is they got excited about politics based on the Women's March. And so it's not protest or do institutional politics. It's usually do both. And if you want to be effective, you have to have people on your side doing both for sure.
Joe, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking about protests and what makes them effective. David Meyer with us from the University of California, Irvine. Back to your calls. Judy is with us in Grand Chute. Judy, hello.
Hello. I'm of the older generation. I was in college in the 60s when the anti-war protests were on. I agreed with their philosophy, but I did nothing. In retrospect, I'd certainly rather be sorry for something I did than for something I didn't do.
Judy, thanks for that call. So Judy regrets not having been involved in protests back in the 60s, David.
Well, I mean, it was a historic moment. It wasn't all pretty. It wasn't all clean. It did wind up mattering a great deal, and it affected politics since. I mean, it was the movement against the war in Vietnam that, according to Richard Nixon, stopped him from threatening the use of nuclear weapons in Vietnam. And it was the movement against the war in Vietnam that basically ended the draft in the United States.
Thanks a lot for that call, Judy, at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Dave in Green Bay. Dave, hi.
Hi. I guess I, too, support the protests. I support both movements that are going on. What I can't support is the rioting and the damage, and I'm afraid that they're going to lose Middle America. That Middle America can't support the damage that's going on, and it's going to actually hurt their cause in the long run, because it's going to help somebody like a Donald Trump get reelected, because he's taking a hardline stance on the police side. So that's my comment.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. And this is again a common theme, I think, in protests, David, the worry that you know, tactics of protesters might turn away otherwise persuadable people?
I don't think most of us like to see windows broken. I don't think most of us like to see people scuffling with police. I think that makes lots of people uncomfortable. In real life, however, when you get lots and lots of people out in the streets, police are called upon to do an extraordinary job, which is to provide protection and social control without making things worse. And the way police act has a lot to do with the way these demonstrations develop. So I think that, you know, the public image of protest matters a great deal, but I think when we look back in history, we tend to sanitize how sloppy and messy real protest movements are.
Thanks a lot for that call, and David, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
We've been talking to David S. Meyer, professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. He studies politics and social movements. You can follow his blog. PoliticsOutdoor.com is the website where you can see his writings from day to day. We talked to him today about the past and future of protests and how they can be effective.